Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A World Ablaze, The Rise of Martin Luther and the Birth of the Reformation, by Craig Harleen, narrated by Bob Sauer. Lo, this is the fire with which they complain that all the world is now ablaze. Dr. Martin Luther to Pope Leo X, May 1518, regarding his 95 Theses. A Word Before. Of making many books there is no end, said Ecclesiastes in chapter 12, and he probably should have added, especially if they're about Martin Luther. This is even more true whenever a big Luther anniversary comes along, like the one so enormously upon us in 2017, 500 whole years since the 95 upsetting theses. But even in ordinary years, a fellow as prolific and cheeky and quotable, as earth-rattling as Luther, who is blamed or praised for changing just about everything in the entire Western world, is going to have his story told more often than most, and in more ways than most, too, because no story is ever told the same way twice, not even a famous one like his. As Luther said himself, even the everlasting gospel, the most famous story of all, was told in all sorts of ways, bluntly, spun out, this way, that. So why wouldn't the story of his thoroughly corruptible flesh be too? My own peculiar telling of his story, meant especially for readers who know the name Luther but aren't exactly sure why, features not just my own sort of spinning and shading and coloring, but also just his first few trembly years of fame, that is, from around the time in late 1517 when the obscure Brother Martin first put together his upsetting theses, until early 1522 when, as a European-wide celebrity, he came out of hiding and started putting his ideas to serious work. It also features a stubborn attempt to set the story relentlessly in his own world and to see through its eyes, not ours, so that we have a fighting chance to grasp the otherness and drama and absolute improbability of the whole astonishing thing. Which means it finally features, just to warn anybody hoping for monumental, Brother Martin, the flesh-and-blood, sometimes cranky friar professor, instead of Luther, the giant bronze icon who changed the entire etc. What Luther did and didn't do during these 4+ years would certainly have giant bronze-worthy consequences that lived on long after he was dust. But this book isn't about those, which are still being argued over. It's about the events of these few years alone, to stress how unlikely and fragile and bewildering they were, and thus to experience them as much as possible in the same nerve-wracking and uncertain way that he did, instead of with an eye roving toward the future, as if the outcome was never in doubt. That's why, for example, I call him mostly Brother Martin or Dr. Martin, not because I'm necessarily on his side or am his special friend, but because people around him called him that, along with Father Martin. Strangers called him Luther, and so did his enemies, who also called him much worse. When the story shifts to their perspective, I call him Luther, too. But calling him only that would make him distant, when the point is to get up close. Sure, there are a few exceptions to this Luther-worldly telling to help move things along. Thus, even though numbers of Bible verses aren't given, because there weren't any numbered verses yet, the story is in mostly modern English, with Bible citations from the New Revised Standard Version. Proposition and article take the more modern form thesis. Distances are in miles and feet. Dates are eventually in months and days. And places and names are in whatever form seemed best suited or most familiar to English readers, instead of always in the original or in English. And so Köln is Cologne, Friedrich is Frederick, François is Francis, and Karl V is Charles V. But Johann, Johannes, Jan, and Hans are all as is, instead of John, while less famous Karls are as is too. And Martin, of course, is always just Martin. Curtain Up. A Hebrew Reading Night. Near Jena in Thuringia, March 4, 1522, Shrove Tuesday, when nothing is ever as it seems. The young travelers were hungry and thirsty, Yes, of course, for knowledge, which was why they'd set out on this long journey in the first place, but at the moment they'd have gladly settled for a little food and drink instead. They were also wet and tired from being slapped around by a storm, and so a good fire and bed sounded just fine, too. The problem was, it was Shrove Tuesday, and so when they finally entered Jena and started asking about rooms, all they heard at every single inn was that there were none. Just as the two travelers, barely 19 years old, headed back out the gate toward a nearby village to see what they could find there, a respectable-looking man who, for some wondrous reason, was also out in the godforsaken weather, pointed them instead toward the much closer Black Bear Inn, just outside Jena's walls. And blessed day, the host there certainly did have a room. No swarming crowds here saw the young men as they clumped over the threshold. Only a solitary fellow in the stove-room, at a table, reading a book in the dim candlelight. He looked up, said a friendly hello, and waved them over. But the muddy and wet pair politely declined and plopped down on a bench near the door. When the fellow kept up his friendliness and drank to their health, though, well, they just couldn't refuse any longer. They went drippily inside and sat with him and ordered some wine, so they could drink his health back, and they no doubt took off their boots and hung their soaked clothing near the stove to get dry. Seated up close like this, the travelers could now see the red hood and doublet and hose and long sword that told them that this fellow was a knight. The knight asked where they were from, but didn't wait for an answer, since he'd already guessed from their accents that they were Swiss. "Yes, from St. Gaul," they nodded. "Ah, coming from that distant southerly direction and at their tender age, then they must," guessed the knight, "be students headed to the University of Wittenberg." Well, they would find there two of their countrymen, the brothers and professors, Hieronymus and Augustin Schurf. This delighted the students because they were carrying letters of introduction to both men. If the knight knew all this, then maybe he knew as well what the students wanted most of all to know, wanted even desperately to know. Was Dr. Martin Luther back in town? Because they were traveling all this way not just to study Holy Scripture, but to study it with him, and they'd heard he'd been gone from Wittenberg for almost a year now. And the knight did know. No, Luther wasn't in Wittenberg at this moment, but Philip Melanchthon was there, and they could take Greek from him and Hebrew from others, both of which they really ought to learn, by the way, if they were serious about studying the Bible. "Praised be God," exclaimed the students, because they wanted to study with Master Philip, too. Still, it was especially Luther they'd hoped for, since they'd been planning their whole lives to become priests, and they'd heard he was now teaching against the Mass and the priesthood. They had to know more about that. "Where have you studied so far?" asked the knight. "At Basel," said the students. "Is Erasmus there?" said the curious knight about the famous man of letters. "What is he up to?" "Nobody really knows, because he keeps to himself." By now the students were wondering how this knight could possibly know about such unknightly subjects as the Schurfs and Erasmus in Greek and Hebrew, and were amazed that he kept throwing Latin words into his sentences. What sort of a knight was this? "Boys, what did they think about this Luther in Switzerland?" the knight continued. "Sir, there are many different opinions. Some can't praise him enough, and they thank God for him, but others say he's a scandalous heretic, especially the pastors." "Ah, yes," replied the unsurprised knight, "those pastors." That broke whatever ice was left, because now the second student reached familiarly and even impolitely across the table to see what the knight was reading. The Psalms, in Hebrew. "I'd have my little finger cut off if I could learn that language," said the student. "Oh, you can, if you stick with it, as I'm doing. I do a little every day," said the knight. While they were talking, the host entered to set the dining table in the next room, as it was good and dark outside now, and time to eat. He'd overheard the students asking about Martin Luther, and so, while walking by them, he said, "If you'd been here 2 days ago, you would have had your wish. He sat at your very table in that very place," he pointed. Hearing that, the students cursed the muddy roads that had slowed them down, but they still liked the idea of being at the very house and table where the famous Luther had been. The host went back out, a little smile on his face, then hush-hushedly waved the first student over and said, "Since you're so eager to see Martin Luther, I'll tell you that that's him sitting next to you." "You're just saying that," said the disbelieving student, "because you know how much I want to see him." "It's the truth, but don't let on that you know." The student went back into the stoveroom and during a lull whispered to his friend what the host had told him about the night, but the friend didn't believe it either. "You must have heard wrong," he said. "The host must have said Hutten, as in Ulrich von Hutten, the famous literary knight, because this fellow looked a lot more like a knight than he did a priest." Two traveling merchants, also looking for shelter, now entered the room as well to dry off, followed by the host, who said that dinner was ready and that they should all move to the dining table. The students hung back and shyly asked the host whether he would be kind enough to give them just a small portion to eat, right where they were sitting, as they were low on money, but the host assured them that he wouldn't charge them much. The mysterious knight, overhearing, went even further. "Come on over, I'll look after the bill," he said. The knight kept up his friendly chatter during the meal, nattering on about how the German princes and nobles and town delegates now assembled in Nuremberg were more worried about jousting and sleigh rides and vanities and whoring than they were about actually solving problems. And he hoped that the next generation of Germans would actually pay attention to gospel truth, since, unlike their parents, they hadn't yet been poisoned by popish errors, which were a devil of a thing to root out. One of the merchants broke in to say that he didn't understand much about the whole recent storm around the Pope. "But this I do say, either this Luther is an angel from heaven or a devil from hell." During all this talk, the knight stayed so cheery that none of his companions would have ever guessed that just a day or two before, at a tavern in Erfurt, he'd gotten into a big vein-popping argument over these very same subjects. When the dinner ended, the merchants went to check on their horses, and the host edged closer to the students to say, "Don't worry about the cost. Martin paid for you." They looked at the still-seated knight again. So he really was Luther? The students thanked him for his kindness and said they had taken him for Ulrich von Hutten. The knight turned to the host. "These Swiss think I am Ulrich von Hutten." "That's ridiculous," said the host. "You are Martin Luther," which made the knight really laugh. "They think I'm Hutten. You say I'm Luther. Pretty soon I'll be Markov, the famous bawdy peasant in a popular old story." Now the students were really confused. Finally, the knight offered them all a tall glass of beer and proposed that, for their evening grace, they should drink together. But when the students went to take a glass, he pulled it back and said he'd forgotten. They weren't used to our outlandish Thuringian beer. So they all drank one more glass of wine instead. Quenched, the knight stood up, threw a cloak over his shoulder, shook their hands, and said, "When you get to Wittenberg, give my greetings to Dr. Schurf." The students said they'd be glad to, but there was one problem. "What's your name, so we can say who greets him?" The knight thought and said, "Just say, 'He who should come salutes you.'" Then he went upstairs to bed, leaving the students as mystified as before. What the knight in the red hood didn't tell the students was that he wasn't a knight at all, but an outlaw, traveling in disguise for his own safety. Anyone who spotted him and had the nerve to grab him could earn a nice reward from the emperor. And what the knight also didn't tell them was that he was on his way to Wittenberg too, just as they were, because he had work to finish there. Or, more precisely, to start. 1. Theses, theses everywhere. Wittenberg, the Friary of the Hermits of St. Augustine, late August 1517, when summer semester is winding down. Mortared bulwarkly into an old southeastern stretch of the wall that had surrounded Wittenberg for more than 200 years were two sturdy towers about 150 feet apart. Just a few years before, the two towers had also been mortared into the brand new home of the Hermits of St. Augustine, as had the stretch of old wall that ran between the towers, because that way the ever-thrifty hermits needed to put up just 3+ walls for their new rectangular building, instead of the usual 4. Plus, they got 2 sturdy towers in the bargain. Sure, the hermits lopped off most of one of the towers because they wanted just its mighty foundation, but they left the southwest tower mostly as it was because they wanted its extra room. Just like the new building it was now joined to, by 3 narrow passageways, this tower had 3 remodeled levels. A cloaca, or cesspit, on the first, a small sleeping room for crammed-in visiting student hermits on the second, and a little heated study on the third, the only heated room in the whole building, because even a self-denying hermit didn't mind a little heat when he was studying, especially in a town where the frosts could last into June. The hermits could have called the whole thing the study tower or visitor tower, but at least one of them seemed to like calling it the cloaca tower instead, as if the ground level were the really crucial part of the whole thing. Oh, that hermit, like the others, was in the actual cloaca plenty, but he was in the third level study even more, and not just for the heat, but especially to carry out the lofty purpose of that lofty room, which was, of course, to study. To tell the truth, the 30 or so hermits who lived in the new building weren't really hermits at all, seeing as how not a single one of them actually lived alone. They weren't even what most ancient bona fide hermits had long ago turned into, which was monks, men who, like hermits, left the world to find God, but who, unlike hermits, did so while living together. No, these so-called hermits had chosen yet another option in the full-time male religious life, that of friars, from French frère and Latin frater, or brother. Yes, friars came together 7 times a day to sing the Hours of the Divine Office, just like monks, and they wore matching habits, just like monks, and they shaved the hair on the top of their head into a big, fleshy, unattractive circle, the tonsure, just like monks, and they looked for God together, just like monks. But what made friars different from monks was that instead of sealing themselves away in a monastery, they went out into the smack dab middle of the world, caring for the poor and sick, and preaching and educating. Educating, that's what the friar on the topmost level of the tower was busy preparing for right now, and at the topmost educational level of his world, too, the university. Brother Martin Luther in the tower was also Dr. Martin Luther, not just a friar in the order of the non-hermit Hermits of St. Augustine, but a professor of theology at the local university. Sometimes he looked every bit the actual hermit, sitting in his study for hours on end. But that had more to do with being a professor than a hermit, even though professors had to be social creatures part of the time, going out in front of students the way they did. They also needed big chunks of hermit-like time alone to think and write and prepare to go out in front of all those students. What made this day different from others was Brother Martin's certainty that some people were going to be furious with what he was preparing. Even though that made him a little nervous, it wouldn't stop him, because he had sworn to profess the true gospel, and so he would, as usual, profess it. Schoolboy. It must have still seemed like a dream sometimes, being up here in the tower at all. It was all God's doing, he was sure of that. Because as a boy in hilly Mansfield, young Martin never could have imagined being a friar, or studying theology, or especially being a professor. Oh, he could have imagined going to school and maybe even going to university, since his mother, Margareta Lindemann, understood better than most that school was a way for a copper smelter son like hers to move a few respectable links up the social chain. And young Martin did well enough at school to stay in it and out of the family smelter, going from Mansfeld's grammar school to its Latin school, and then at 14 and 15 to even better Latin schools in Magdeburg and Eisenach, which was an absolutely sure sign that somebody besides his mother thought he had what it took to be among the very few people of his world, less than 1 in 100, who went on to university, where classes were in much more sophisticated Latin than the let's get acquainted sort he'd learned in Mansfeld. That somebody was right, because young Martin survived the floggings and humiliations and drudgery that were the hallmarks of schools for the young, and in April 1501 he headed 60 miles south of Mansfeld to the University of Erfurt, fifth oldest, 1392, and third biggest, 500 students, of the 16 or so universities in the entire Holy Roman Empire. Martin's father, Hans Luther, was soon wide awake to the possibilities of higher education, too, and now gladly paid out even more for tuition, books, paper, ink, quills, scholar's robe, linens, firewood, board, room, and so on than ever before, because what a boon to the family business it would be if his son should study law, and what a boost to family fortunes if he should somehow get a foothold in local politics, or become a counselor to the Count of Mansfeld, or even to the Count's overlord, the Duke of Saxony himself, as Margareta's cousin Johann Lindemann now was. And so, Martin suffered the usual hazing of new university students that almost always seemed to involve soot and feces and prophetic water, urine, and fake donkey ears, all supposedly meant to awaken him to his new status, but probably more to allow older students a little revenge for their own suffering years before. He endured the monk-like regime of his dormitory at Erfurt, called Heaven's Gate, up at 4 a.m., class at 6 a.m., 2 meals a day, no girls allowed inside, and chanting through all 150 psalms every 15 days. And more than anything, Martin studied the grammar, rhetoric, and logic that all new students studied, and that were dished out in the methods used since universities were invented 4 centuries before: lectures, repetitions, and disputations. Up to 3 times a day, he hustled over to dimly lit lecture halls where a master read and commented on some authoritative text, while students scribbled and dozed. Every day and night, he attended dimly lit repetitions where he reviewed what he'd heard in lectures. And every Friday, he attended a dimly lit practice disputation where a master set out some disputable assertions, called propositions or articles, then much later theses. A few advanced students defended those assertions, a few other advanced students attacked them, and younger students like Martin watched wide-eyed. Surely, Martin attended as well the crowning spectacle of higher education, the very occasional public disputation held during important ceremonies like graduation, or even as separate extraordinary events, because what better way to celebrate something big than with a few hours of fine-sliced arguing in front of the whole school, and visitors too? Disputations weren't just fun and games and long stretches of dullness, mind you. All the posturing and exaggerating and attacking were also supposed to produce some clarity and even truth, but usually it was all more about winning than truth-seeking, more like a tournament, in fact, with usually figurative snorts and blows and thrusts and parries instead of the actual sort. Martin did well enough in his basic studies in Erfurt that, at the soonest possible moment, in September 1502, he became part of an even smaller elite in his world, one of the 3 in 10 university students who actually earned a Bachelor of Arts degree, meaning the 3 basic arts of grammar, rhetoric, and logic. Although he finished a modest 30th in a class of 57, it was enough to make him want to continue his studies and to earn what only 1 in 10 university students ever earned, a Master of Arts degree. This meant studying the remaining 4 arts, music, arithmetic, geometry, and astronomy, plus Aristotle's metaphysics, Aristotle's ethics, Aristotle's politics, Aristotle's natural philosophy, later called science, in fact, Aristotle's just about everything, and doing a lot more disputing than ever before. Martin may not have loved the attacking part of disputing, because when wounded, his angry side came furiously out, but disputing surely helped him hone his talent for reducing huge messes of words and thoughts to a pithy, if sometimes racy, few, which talent might have had much to do with why he finished 2nd in his class this time out of 17. When he received his M.A. in January 1505, it meant he was qualified to lecture on all 7 arts, to run disputations and, if he wanted, to study for another master's degree in one of the 3 advanced subjects available at universities: theology, law, and medicine. Martin did indeed want to study even more, or at least his father wanted him to, as long as the subject was law. And so Martin dutifully made the 15-mile trip from Erfurt to Gotha, where he could buy a huge edition of the standard law book, the Corpus Juris. He started class with it in May 1505, and, like other new students, began memorizing the titles of laws. But one long day in July, Martin took his books back to the shop in Gotha for a refund and told everybody he was quitting law because he wanted instead to be a Mönch, the word German speakers use to mean either monk or friar. Brother Martin, what in the world had happened? Maybe a few weeks of law were enough to convince Martin that he hated the subject, or maybe he was trying to escape a marriage Father Hans had arranged for him. But it was mostly, said Martin, because God gave him no choice. By that, he could have meant how seriously he'd started to worry about the state of his soul. He'd always been sensitive and had worried about his soul before, including 2 years before when he'd accidentally stabbed himself in the leg with a student dagger he always carried, then almost bled to death in a field. But the sudden death of a couple of law professors and students around January 1505 scared Martin so badly that, he said, he almost died himself. Sudden death could make anybody worry, of course, even in a world where sudden death happened all the time. In fact, maybe especially in such a world, because it was impossible to pretend it couldn't happen to you. Still, these particular deaths were worse than usual. One of them even made him worry about his body as well as his soul, because, as some later hinted, he might have actually caused that death in a duel. Years later, he even supposedly said himself, "Because of God's extraordinary decision, I was made a friar so that they could not capture me. Otherwise, I very easily would have been captured." That was wonderfully vague, but it wasn't far-fetched that civic authorities in Erfurt were indeed after him, just as they were after other students who fought duels, including one who had recently killed the protégé of a French cardinal. University authorities, however, wouldn't have wanted the bad publicity of such a thing, and could have well been happy to just let Martin disappear into a monastery. But again, the whole story was vague. If it was true, then even if the death was accidental or in self-defense, it would have been easy for Martin to feel that the only way to pay for the deed, the only way to avoid further investigation, the only way to save his soul, was to devote himself full-time to God. But Martin could have had another terrifying event in mind, too, when he said God gave him no choice. In the summer of 1505, Martin was summoned home to Mansfeld, very possibly to hear the news about the arranged marriage. That alone might have stunned Martin. But what terrified him happened on the walk back to Erfurt, when one of Thuringia's heaven-splitting thunderstorms suddenly broke out, frightening him so badly that he frantically cried out, "Help me, St. Anne, I will become a monk." Now, vowing to become a monk or friar was common enough for extra-sensitive souls fretting over their salvation, since it was fairly common knowledge that if you died wearing a monk's or friar's cowl, you could hope for special treatment at the Last Judgment. But having the vow forced upon him this dramatically could have easily made Martin feel that God was behind it all, and had even arranged the thunderstorm expressly for him, to make it absolutely clear that his particular soul would require something a lot more drastic than the ordinary burgher's life that he, and especially his father, had envisioned for him. At first, Martin regretted how rashly he'd made that vow. But knowing that not honoring it might lead to even more wrath from God, he sold his law books and decided to follow through. He was going to enter the religious life. Whatever was behind the decision, his business-minded father was livid and immediately disowned Martin. It was fine to be pious, but something else altogether to throw away all of Hans's hopes and hard-earned money. Only many months later, after two of his other sons died of the plague and a rumor went around that Martin had two, did Hans grudgingly go along. He must have felt like God wasn't giving him any choice either. Erfurt's 25 churches and 11 monasteries and friaries and 28 parishes made it one of the churchiest towns in northern Christendom and gave Martin plenty of places to choose from to start his new life. On July 16, 1505, he announced his decision at a farewell dinner with friends. He would enter the local Hermits of St. Augustine, an order of friars founded in 1244 by Pope Innocent IV himself, the only religious order ever founded by a pope. The next day, a couple of friends walked with him to the gate, where he asked to be admitted. It was no surprise that Martin chose a place known for its strict living, because if entering a religious house improved your chances at salvation, then entering a strict religious house had to improve them even more. These were, after all, the observant hermits of St. Augustine, who implied with that frontal adjective that they actually followed the order's rules, unlike their more relaxed brothers, the conventual hermits from whom they'd split away. But it wasn't just the strictness that appealed to Martin, because he could have gotten even more of that with the local Carthusian monks. No, it was the Augustinians' mighty tradition of learning, too. Martin wanted to keep on studying after all, but just not law. The Augustinians had ties to all sorts of universities and pushed their members to study theology, which Martin sensed might help with all the fretting he was doing over his salvation. Yes, he could have gotten university-level theology with the Dominicans or Franciscans, who were also friars, but he later said that the first were too proud and the second too casual.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?